A shock resignation delivers another blow to the Liberal Party. Shadow Home Affairs Minister John O'Dunham is set to leave Parliament this year. It comes as the Coalition continues to feel the pressure from One Nation. And Pauline Hanson broadens her attack, now going after Labor too. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. John O'Dunham is widely considered one of the Liberal Party's strongest performers. This morning, the Shadow Home Affairs Minister has confirmed he's quitting and will leave Parliament later this year. He's told the ABC he's made the decision with the family to be home more and has let Angus Taylor know. It's a big loss for the opposition at one of its lowest points. Liberals continue to argue over what to do about One Nation, which is now also targeting Labor. Acknowledging voters are fed up, the Prime Minister and Treasurer say they're the ones trying to break the status quo, unlike their opponents who want to keep everything as it is.
The rise and rise of One Nation.
Here she is now, Pauline Hanson, our Senator of Australia.
One Nation's primary vote, ahead of Labor, and well on the way to doubling the coalitions.
One Nation's not the answer for change.
They don't trust you anymore.
Many people feel that the system isn't working for them.
People are angry.
And they don't feel their lives are getting better.
They're sending a message to the major parties that they want us to do better.
So they've had a gutful.
To, you know, paraphrase, yeah, it's the economy, stupid.
One Nation today, I think, is different to the One Nation that we first saw emerge on the political scene.
And it takes me back to the memories when I was in prison in 2003. And you, the people, never gave up on me.
The opposition has left the door open to a preference deal with One Nation.
We'll work with others to get rid of this rotten Labor government.
The Liberal One National Party are indistinguishable.
Tony Passon wants the Liberal Party to work out which Liberal and One Nation candidates should run so they're not competing with each other. Will you do it?
No, there's no plan.
The extraordinary statement by Tony Passon saying that the Liberal Party should give up on trying to win seats.
There'll be no carve-up of seats, and what we're going to be doing is carving up the Labor Party that's failed this country.
And I'm going to target those Labor seats, not coalition.
Labor has started a fundraising campaign to fight Pauline Hanson's political movement.
I don't think Labor has anything to fear from One Nation.
Australians are amidst a cost-of-living crisis, and the Prime Minister wants everybody to donate.
That's what your party does as well. The problem for you is that you have no supporters left.
One Nation claims its anti-Albanese fundraiser has raked in nearly $1 million in a single day.
Did she, though? Did she?
Contributions are streaming in, the campaign to fire the liar.
He can't imagine One Nation getting the support that we have.
It's a farce, complete farce.
I'm focusing on the Australian people. The Prime Minister focuses on all sorts of other things.
We'll continue to actually be interested in making a difference to people's lives, and that is what we will focus on.
To get that amount of money, it says the Australian people have had a gutful of him. They want him gone.
Well, let's bring in our panel this morning. We are joined by the Australian Financial Review's National Affairs columnist Jennifer Hewitt, Raf Epstein, the host of ABC Radio Melbourne Mornings, and Chief International Correspondent for the Australian newspaper Cameron Stewart. Very good morning to all of you. Let's start with the breaking news this morning, this shock resignation from John O'Dunham. I spoke to him earlier this morning. He told me that after much consideration, my family and I made the call that it was time for me to be home more. It was a tough call after 25 years in and around politics. He says he let Angus know some weeks ago, gave him a commitment that he'll do what needs doing to finish the job that he's asked me to do. Jennifer, that means there will need to be a reshuffle of the front bench sometime soon, you would expect, if he's going before the end of the year. And in the Senate, you can just leave and be replaced without the need for a by-election. But right now, given where the Liberal Party's at, how big a blow is this?
Oh, I think it's just another big blow for the Liberal Party. Yes, it's the timing is very bad for Angus Taylor, clearly, as he's trying to, you know, struggle and demonstrate that he can somehow provide hope to the Liberal Party that there is going to be a better time ahead. So, yes, there's no doubt Dunningham is one of the best performers on the front bench. It's something that they really can't afford to lose him. It's most unfortunate that he is going for all the reasons. We know that politics can be a very, very tough business, but... And people will perceive it, of course, as, they're just, you know...
Leaving the sinking ship.
Yeah, that's right.
There are some genuine family reasons there. We don't need to go into that, but his colleagues are all acknowledging that as well, Raf. They're all also saying he is one of our safest pair of hands, and you know, having interviewed him as well, he is one of their most solid performers.
Yeah, someone texted me this morning to say he's one of their safest pair of hands. He took over the number one Senate spot at the 22 election from Erica Betts. The sinking ship thing, all of his friends are saying it's not about that, but it's got to hurt. Someone else said to me he's really good at negotiating in the Senate. Like, he's just a good person, policy smarts, political smarts. It looks terrible. Mind you, the Liberal Party have got enough problems that we'll get on to. I don't know if it makes a substantial difference, but if you're on that team and you're trying to present a united front, it's just another step backwards.
Let's talk about the broader problems that the Liberal Party's got, and that is One Nation, of course. But, Cam, we also saw, and we saw it there in that piece, One Nation, this, the story really turning from just what's happening on the coalition side to the One Nation Labor contest now as well.
Yeah, we saw really a whiff of panic, I think, from both parties this week over the polls. Really, both parties not knowing how to actually respond. We had, from the Labor side, as you say, they started their attack. Jim Chalmers saying, Pauline Hanson's divisive. But we had former Treasurer Wayne Swan saying Labor Party should speak like the working man and woman. You know, so he was suggesting that they change their vernacular. Mm. And then, of course, we had a class sort of attack, if you like, on Pauline Hanson saying, look, you know, she listens to Gina Rinehart. She flies on Gina Rinehart's jet. So you can see the Labor Party, like the Liberals, just grasping, if you like, at straws to try and find a way to look at this. But as far as the class attack on Pauline Hanson goes, I think that's very unlikely to succeed. I mean, if you look at, if it's to say that she is detached from the working Australian, if you look at the story overseas, who won the working class vote in America? A billionaire who builds skyscrapers, who turns up to rallies on a plane with Trump written on it. Mm. And who won the working class vote in Britain? Nigel Farage, a multi-millionaire. So I'm not sure that angle will work.
Not to mention Donald Trump is a billionaire and at least historically has been able to win support from the battlers. On the way One Nation, Raf, has responded to Labor, it's that fundraising drive, Fire the Liar. Now, we know that word liar, Labor used a devastating effect against Scott Morrison, the liar from the Shire, they called him. It is a word that, if it sticks, can be really damaging. What do you make of how One Nation is now going to use this against Anthony Albanese?
I don't want to keep repeating the phrase, but I have to. So Fire the Liar, first of all, is a Peter Credlin line, and One Nation admit that. It's incredibly powerful. The three-word phrase is not just being used by One Nation. I actually asked a colleague to do a search, a media monitoring search. In the 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it was used more than 1,800 times, TV, radio, online. Now, can anyone on this couch remember the words on Labor's fundraiser? There were two three-word slogans. Can anyone remember?
Can't say I can.
No. Stop One Nation, fund the fight. But I had to look it up. So there's a real sense of media boosterism, and I think it's fair to say there are some real sections of the media cheering them on. But I think it actually goes, the reason the media is cheering them on goes a bit to what you say about class, that it's a mistake, not a mistake, but it's not so useful anymore to think about it as people on the left versus people on the right. The thing that I found really useful is we have to think of Farage, Trump, and now in Australian politics, it's finally arrived. It's people at the bottom versus people at the top. If you can show you're at the bottom and punching up, you're winning. Doesn't matter if a billionaire is giving you a plane. If you can portray your opponent as being at the top and punching down, and that's the danger for the Prime Minister, is Pauline Hanson portrays him that way, that's where the energy is. It's people on top versus people at the bottom, and the left-right thing is not as instructive. They've turbocharged that.
There are clearly many reasons why we're seeing this momentum behind One Nation, and that's no doubt a part of it. I was talking to someone in One Nation who even acknowledged that it is a little hard to explain what's going on. They said it's a bit like AI. You don't know how it works, it just works.
It's just happening. Yeah, it is that kind of politics of grievance, though. And it's like trying to grab smoke when you're trying to fight against it, because it's just, you know, everywhere, and it can be used for all sorts of, you know, emotive reasons and also reality. You know, people are feeling hard done by. Yeah. But I do think it's interesting. I noticed that Albanese now refers to Angus Taylor as one of the opposition leaders, which I thought was hilarious.
Three-ring circus.
But I do think that this return by Labor to saying, oh, look, it's all about class, and they're basically both trying to say that Pauline Hanson is owned by Jeannie Reinhart and she's really not on the side of the workers, and so is Angus Taylor, you know, a silver spoon in his mouth, that type of thing. I just don't think that works.
But does it work for Labor to say, we're actually the ones trying to break the status quo, do something, make change
but
on housing?
But don't use the word status quo. Like, it's really simple. One Nation used the language of anger.
Yeah.
Labor needs to use the language of change. They still haven't got some simple, clear lines for the budget. You've got the biggest tax change in 30 years colliding with the biggest change in our politics in 80 years.
Mm.
Where are their simple... We are something like, and they use this in Britain, we are punishing you for every dollar you earn in overtime and giving you a free ride for every dollar that you just hold on to. That clear language is missing.
And just quickly on the Liberal side, that Tony Passon suggestion in your newspaper, Cam, about a carve-up where the Liberals wouldn't run in some seats. It was shot down very quickly by Angus Taylor. But does this talk to some panic still about what to do?
Absolutely. And then we had Angus Taylor and Tony Abbott flirting with the concept of preference deals down the track. Mm. I thought the voice of reason from the Liberals this week was Senator James Patterson, who said, look, you know, you can't make any decision now. It's far too early.
2 years out.
But also he said, you know, you've got to make sure who the candidates are, because it's true, One Nation candidates can be like the bar scene from Star Wars. You never quite know what you're going to get, you know. And so they do have to kind of watch that very carefully, and there's no need to make a decision now. So I think that sort of will be their strategy going forward. But it's just a complete whiff of panic today, this week.
Yeah, and it was so unnecessary, I think. It's going to be a kind of hand-to-hand combat in different seats, but it's not something you know, need to worry about now. And also, as we know, exactly how the preference... It's going to be all about preferences. How they're going to actually break is going to be very, very different. I mean, and One Nation supporters don't necessarily follow any particular line anyway.
And, you know, I mean, parties talk about principle a lot, but ultimately they're pragmatists. And coming, I think in the end, if the Liberals consider they can't win without dancing in some form with One Nation close to the poll, I think you'll find them on the dance floor.
Well, they've done it before.
Just one more thing on One Nation. It's Pauline Hanson especially, she is held to a different standard. There is no way on earth.
But that's like populists in
general. Well, it is, but it's up... So she can say what she likes, but it's up to us and it's up to other politicians whether or not we grade people differently. She could never say, show me the good Jews.
Yes,
right?
She could not say,
Jews are slowly taking control of Britain and France. She says that about Muslims. So we are the people in the media who mark her on a different standard.
Well,
that matters.
I think people mark on a different standard, the same way that, you know, Trump can get away with saying things that no other politician could.
Mm.
I actually don't think the media are nearly as important as you suggest. I think it's what people respond to.
Is that a problem, though?
Well, it may be a problem, but that's the reality.
And you don't think there's a role for the media? It's not our job to... we don't get to say whether or not people get votes, but the way we frame what they say, if she said that about Jews, there'd be a discussion on this couch about whether or not she should be prosecuted
under
hate laws.
But I think there's plenty of discussion in the media.
There was plenty of discussion at the time of those comments. But, take your point. All right, well, time to turn to the National Disability Insurance Scheme and talk to the minister responsible, Mark Butler. First, some of the evidence at the three-day inquiry during the week into the government's plan to rein in the NDIS.
When disabled people die as a direct result of this bill, and they will, their blood will be on your hands.
It will push people back towards systems that have already failed our community. It will lead to serious neglect, injury, illness and death.
By agreeing to this bill, you are telling the government that it's okay to end my life.
It will strip our children and ourselves of rights. We will be made second-class citizens in our own country, and it will kill people.
Mark Butler, welcome to the program. Look, this was a serious charge and it was made repeatedly at those hearings. Will people die as a result of these changes?
No, they won't, David. The NDIS is probably the most significant social reform this country's made since Medicare in the 80s. It's transformed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Australians for the better, and I completely understand why they're desperately concerned to hang on to that reform. I'm desperately concerned to do that as well. But the truth is the NDIS has got way off track. It's grown far too big, it costs too much, and it's become a honeypot for shonks and rorters. And that's why I've laid out this comprehensive plan, much of which reflects discussions that have been ongoing since the NDIS review was delivered 3 years ago now, to secure its future for people like those who are giving evidence to the Senate inquiry. But I want to reassure them, this will still be the biggest social program Australia has outside the age pension. It will grow every year, way bigger than Medicare, and it will remain the centrepiece of the most comprehensive suite of supports you will find anywhere in the world for people with disability, anywhere in Europe, anywhere in North America.
Well, let's go through some of the specific concerns that were raised, particularly on that safety issue. Under your bill, participants must exhaust all appropriate treatments before they can access the NDIS. Will some people then have to try riskier treatments, whether it's psychotropic drugs, menstrual suppressants, before they're allowed onto the NDIS?
No, we'll take a very common sense approach to all this. I mean, the point of principle is that the NDIS was never intended to replace entirely health systems, rehabilitation systems and the like. It was set up for people with significant and permanent disability, but we've been very clear in our evidence and in the explanatory memorandum that we would only expect people to take avail themselves of reasonable systems of support. For example,
we've said in the hearing... So who makes that decision on whether someone has engaged in all appropriate treatments? Who decides whether they have or they haven't?
Yeah, well, that will be the subject of further negotiation and advice in the months going forward.
I've said, for example, can't you say now what your plan is there, or you haven't worked that out?
Well, there are so many different permutations here. What we've tried to do is give some examples, David. For example, people with hearing loss would not be expected to avail themselves of a cochlear implant, an invasive sort of treatment. Highly effective, but it should be up to the individual and their family whether they avail themselves of that. We wouldn't expect them to undertake psychotropic treatment that would effectively amount to chemical restraint. We've been very clear about that as well. So obviously we'd take a deeply ethical approach to this, not expect people to avail themselves of treatments that anyone would regard as unreasonable.
But the details
I come back to that point. The NDIS was never intended to replace the broader health system and rehabilitation systems.
The other safety concern raised that came up at the inquiry was around the plan to cut funding for community and social participation. You want to save, I think, $13 billion or more. The Disability Discrimination Commissioner was amongst those raising concerns about this. She said that this would leave people with a disability severely isolated, increasing their vulnerability to abuse and violence. Are you willing to shift on this element?
No, we're focused on this as a really important way to control costs, but also deliver better supports for people engaging in social activity. What it's allowed us to do, importantly, given some of the evidence that you played in your introduction, is to secure core supports. So in no way will the core supports people rely upon in accommodation, in their activities of daily living, like showering, meals preparation, hygiene, continence, all those sorts of things, transport,
the their community employment participation arrangements. Will be cut.
The social activity budgets will be pared back to where it was in 2025. We've seen it grow enormously in the last 5 years. It's grown from $4 billion to $12 billion in just 5 years. It costs now just social activity the same as the PBS. We've got to constrain that growth. It will still be a very, very substantial budget for people.
But will less community participation mean more isolation? This was the point that the Disability Commissioner raised.
Well, it will still be substantially more than people were getting 2-3 years ago, way more than they were getting 5 years ago. But we do have to constrain that growth. Without the reforms I'm putting in place, that would grow to $20 billion by the end of the decade. That's simply not a sustainable position. It's also allowed us, as I said, to protect the core supports people rely upon for that safety that was part of your introduction.
Look, the states and territories have made a joint submission to the inquiry, raising a number of serious concerns. They said that what you're doing is inconsistent with commitments by all governments at National Cabinet in January, and that the significant projected participant exits by 2031 are not accompanied by clearly defined alternative supports. On that first point, the states didn't sign up to cutting the growth rate of the NDIS down to 2%, did they?
Well, the state agreements that the premiers, not the disability ministers, the premiers and chief ministers signed are very clear. First of all, to return the NDIS to its original purpose of supporting people with significant permanent disability. The eligibility changes we make in this bill does that. Secondly, to get it back to 5% growth going forward. You're right that the growth will be less than that in the forward estimates the first 4 years, but that's because we have to reset the scheme to get it on a path for that sustainable growth that you see in systems like Medicare. And as to the system of supports outside the scheme, we've been talking with states about this for 3 years now. There is $10 billion allocated collectively by governments. That decision was made way back in 2023. And of course, we've got to get on with that job. That's what I want to do with disability ministers rather than continuing to receive submissions like that. We've got a lot of work to do in the next 18 months before those new eligibility rules start to take effect. They'll then roll out through reassessments over the following 3 years. So it's a fairly long period of time to shift to this new scheme. But I accept we've got a lot of work to do in that time.
A lot of work to do. And from what the states are saying, they're not ready. What they're recommending, the states and territories, is that you specifically align the development of those foundational supports to the winding back of the NDIS so that the two are linked. Will you agree to that alignment?
Well, the Prime Minister and I have said we're not going to let people fall between two stools. We're not going to make changes that leave people without support. But I'm also not going to raise the white flag on those timeframes now. I want the disability ministers to get on with the job with the Commonwealth of designing those foundational supports.
But if they're not ready, is what you're saying this morning that you'll slow down the cuts to the NDIS if those state supports aren't ready?
The Prime Minister and I have said that since I announced the plan 8 weeks ago here. Of course, we're not going to leave people without support, but equally, I'm not going to make that surrender now. We've got to get on with the job. We've got to get this scheme back on track and look to the Thriving Kids arrangements that you're familiar with, David, for the arrangements for kids under nine. States are getting busy with setting up those plans. They've published their plans in the most part. They're starting to scale up systems of support for families and children under nine in locations families would be very comfortable and familiar with, child and parent centres, playgroups, there'll be targeted supports. All of that now is able to be seen online. So, you know, I think there's a bit of posturing going on through this process. I think
from
states,
who?
Territories...
And who's doing the
from
posturing?
State ministers. I'll be clear about that. I think that submission was an extraordinary submission given the clear commitments that premiers signed on to a few months ago, in exchange for which the Commonwealth has made available $25 billion in additional funding to hospitals.
So you think they're just trying to squeeze more money out of you? Is that the bottom line?
I don't know what they're trying to do. You have to ask them that. But this was a package deal, and I think the community now expects all governments to get on with the job of delivering it. Better hospital services and an NDIS that is secured for the long term.
And what about those in the disability sector we heard from at the hearing during the week? Do you think they're also putting it on?
No, I've been clear since I announced this plan that these are big changes and they will be very confronting for people. I remember life in the disability sector before the NDIS as well. The transformation, as I said, has been profound and long overdue, and I understand why people want to hang on to it desperately. But I also want to give them an assurance. As I said, this will be a program that grows. It's the most comprehensive system of supports on the planet for people with disability. And most of the work to implement the plan that I announced 8 weeks ago doesn't happen when the bill's passed, but happens over coming months. And of course, we will do that in close consultation with the disability sector as well as with states.
So, listening to you this morning, it doesn't sound like you are willing to make any significant changes to what you've put forward in this legislation. Is that correct?
Look, the direction of travel, I think, is an important one for us to follow through. This largely reflects reviews and insights that we've gathered over the last 3 years since that independent review was done of the NDIS in 2023 and endorsed by all governments at National Cabinet later that year. I'm utterly convinced this is the right plan for the NDIS and the hundreds of thousands of people that it supports.
And nothing you've heard at the hearings over the last week have changed your view?
Well, I'm not saying that there won't be any change. We've heard some ideas from the crossbench in the debate in the House of Representatives. I've certainly very much heard that people want greater reassurance about what won't change because of the reforms that we're putting in place. So I'm certainly not saying that we're not looking at things constructively. I'm looking forward to the report being delivered, as I've said over the last few days while the hearings have been underway. But the direction of travel, the need to make big changes that secure this incredibly important social program for the future, I'm convinced is the right direction of travel.
So no big change, but you are open to some adjustment. Can you give us a sense of what you've heard that you might have to rethink?
No, I don't want to preempt the report that's due to be delivered on Tuesday, David. I really don't. Okay. I want to give the Senate the respect that the inquiry deserves. It was a comprehensive set of evidence that they took over those few days. We've had hundreds of submissions that I imagine they're working over the weekend to collate and develop into a report.
Well, the other strong point made across the board was that this is not long enough, this inquiry. It needs to be longer. And indeed, the Coalition is now saying they'd agree to a six-month extension of the inquiry if the Greens agree to a six-month extension of the tax inquiry. What would a six-month delay in starting these NDIS changes, what would that mean?
Well, it would be 6 months more without the reform that the scheme needs. 6 months more of, you know, frankly, people receiving services that aren't as good as they should be, because a lot of the reforms that we're putting in place are to improve the quality of supports and services, to improve arrangements around integrity and fighting fraud. It would also, though, mean billions of dollars in the budget. $17 billion would be lost with a 12-month delay. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to work out what a six-month delay
would involve. $8 or $9 billion cost?
I don't have the precise figure. It's not exactly 50% of the 12-month figure, but it will run to billions and billions of dollars. And I've not heard Angus Taylor make an argument why this inquiry has not been long enough in and of itself. He's simply trying to use this as a pawn in a bigger chess game that he's seeking to play about other areas of the budget. He should focus, I think, on what the best thing is for NDIS reform. He made some very constructive remarks in his budget reply speech about this. Melissa McIntosh, the shadow minister, has been very constructive to engage with as well. So, you know, I'd caution them about using what is a really important reform process as a pawn in a bigger game.
Just on some other issues, Mark Butler, the rise of One Nation. How damaging is this Fire the Liar campaign?
Oh, look, I think these campaigns come and they go. We've all run them, all political parties. We get a bit of online fundraising. We do a whole lot of social media, as I think Raf was saying in the introduction. There's been a whole lot of free media boosting of this as well. So, you know, it will come and it will go. I think the broader question here, I think, is how we manage the fact that the community is really hurting. You know, people have just experienced wave after wave of pressure on their household budgets, on their sense of security going forward for themselves and for their kids. We had the pandemic, we had the war in Ukraine, which spiked inflation around the world. And most recently, we've seen that happen again in the war in Iran. And we get that people are understandably sick of it. They just want some relief.
Have you personally spoken to anyone about why they're supporting One Nation?
Well, I think it's pretty clear they're sick of the status quo. But look, I think our job as government certainly...
Have you had any conversations with anyone about this?
Sure. People are engaging with my office. They're engaging with me about this. This is not a new dynamic. It might have a slightly new face, but this is not a new dynamic in Australian politics for us. You know, we focus as a Labor Party on our job of doing everything in government we can to make things easier for people, delivering more tax cuts, giving people a fairer break in housing, in my areas of responsibility, cleaning up things that need to be put back on track, like the NDIS, while we make medicines and doctor visits more affordable as well. But on the other side of politics, I think you do see a very significant shift happening. What I think you've seen over the last week is really One Nation breaking cover and making it clear that they're actually not interested in fighting the coalition. They want to take over the coalition. And now you'll see, I think, a period of time...
Well, I think they're going after Labor, aren't they, with this campaign?
Well, that's right. They take over the coalition because fundamentally they are an anti-Labor party.
Okay.
And the coalition is being rewritten and renegotiated. You'll see this happen under President Tony Abbott, where they think about preference deals, whether or not they're going to make way for each other in particular seats, although I hear Angus Taylor try to shut that down this week. It will come up again over the next couple of years.
We'll see.
And you'll have the same policies you've always had from the anti-Labor coalition forces, with some new faces perhaps, maybe with a harder edge, but opposed to wage increases, hostile to Medicare, and determined to divide Australia and talk the country down at a really difficult time.
Do you believe One Nation raised $3.7 million in a matter of days?
I honestly don't have a view about it, David. I haven't looked at it. Look, these things can raise a lot of money very, very quickly, and
Labor's
I wouldn't be surprised if
like
they
that,
had
so quickly. Have they?
I honestly don't know. I don't look at what we raise either, David. I know that these online fundraising can go viral pretty quickly, and at a time where people are understandably sick of the way in which. Global politics and the economy is impacting their household budgets. It wouldn't surprise me.
Okay. Finally, Donald Trump says a deal with Iran is soon to be signed. And as for Iran's nuclear dust, as he calls it, the US will go in and get it at an appropriate time when it is calm. If the war ends with Iran still maintaining its uranium stockpile, what has this achieved?
Well, we said at the outset as a government that we supported an objective that sought to make sure that Iran would never secure a nuclear weapons capability and also sought to constrain its ability to hurt its neighbours and, frankly, countries as far away as Australia. We've seen that over the last couple of years, as you know. But we've also said for some time those objectives appear to have been met and it's time to bring this war to a close.
Has it been met, though, if they've still got the uranium?
Well, let's see how these negotiations play out over the next little while, whether it's 24 hours, as we've heard from the US president, or slightly longer. None of us is counting our chickens quite yet, David, but we all want to see this egg hatch as soon as it possibly can.
Has it been worthwhile, this war?
Well, that will take a little bit of time to analyse,
sure.
I think. We supported those objectives. We think they were worthwhile
sure
objectives.
It's been a worthwhile war.
Yeah, I mean, the damage done to the global economy, the damage done to humanity in the area in particular has been profound. I mean, Iran was a rogue terrorist state. It had caused damage to our own country on the other side of the world and continued to destabilise that important region. So the status quo was really difficult to maintain. I get that. But this has been an incredibly damaging conflict to the global economy and has fed what we were just talking about in terms of, you know, people's sense of insecurity and dissatisfaction with how things are going.
Health Minister and Minister for Ageing, the Disability and the NDIS, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Mark Butler.
Thanks, David.
All right, well, coming up, the US and Iran do say they're closer than ever to signing a deal. But we have been here before. What will this look like? Will there finally be peace in the Middle East? First, let's bring in our panel once more. Jennifer Hewitt from the Australian Financial Review, Raf Epstein from ABC Radio Melbourne, and Cameron Stewart from The Australian. Let's just pick up on the NDIS discussion there, Jennifer. It doesn't sound like Mark Butler is interested in any significant changes to what they've put forward to, despite what we've heard at this inquiry.
No, I think that's right. I mean, what he's trying to say is that we need to protect those core services for people who do have severe and permanent disability, and it's spread much, much too widely. And his talk about social and community services, for example, now costing $12 billion. You, of course, have people who have got severe problems who are helped by that, but you've also got an awful lot of people who... where carers or all sorts of people can sign up and be paid $75 to drive people to the cinema or cooking classes or take them on holidays. And that type of thing, look, of course it's great to have, but it's impossible to say that is a good idea.
There is, in fairness, also a lot of legitimate community participation that has changed lives, that
has allowed people to engage in
society that they weren't able to previously. But it's all come at a great cost, as we can see. Raf, clearly from that interview, there's a big difference between the feds, the Commonwealth, and the state ministers. And Mark Butler had a go at them there. How should the sector be feeling if the two levels of government that are meant to be co-governing this NDIS are fighting like this?
I think it worries the people who provide the services. I think it worries the NDIS participants even more. I actually tried to... What Mark Butler was saying there and what the government is saying is, look, we've got to protect this for the people who need it in the future. And I actually tried that. Beth called from Sunbury. Beth has a rare form of arthritis. Mm-hmm. She has a whole lot of other intellectual problems. She gets help to shower, she gets help to go to the doctor, those sort of things. She's worried she's going to lose the social and community participation, the sort of budget you're talking
that's
about.
That's the type of person he's saying will not lose those supports.
I understand that. I'm not sure Beth understands that. And to go to your point about the providers, no one knows for sure what the changes will be. And when I said to Beth, well, hold on, this is all about making sure that people like you in the future will be OK, she's like, yeah, but I'm the Beth that's here now and I'm suffering. So it's normal for the states and the feds to have that fight. The people in the system are still terrified that they won't get what they really need to sort of be out and about in the community. And I think on top of that, to go to the people at the top versus people at the bottom, if you cut older people's private health insurance and it sounds like you're cutting people's NDIS, a lot of voters just see that, hear that, and they go, oh, hang on, you're not taxing the gas companies, you're doing that. It is another reason for people to vote One Nation.
And Mark Butler sounds like he's not for the turning. It sounds to me like he's very concerned about opening a Pandora's box. If you start to get more consultation, more delays, et cetera, et cetera, it means the cuts don't come earlier. Of course, the cuts to NDIS are structurally important to Labor's future budget strategy. So he's really, while states and the feds are pointing fingers at each other, I mean, the terrible thing is that some people will miss out in some form with these cuts. Mm. And, you know, we had a lot of politicking here, but he doesn't sound like he's for the turning. I think they'll go ahead.
The other problem is, of course, they have baked in to the budget,
yes,
as he said, 2% growth. Well, I mean, I don't think anybody actually believes that.
Which is below inflation, right?
Well, it's well below inflation. And how is that going to work? That's part of the...
It's baked into the budget spending,
which the bottom line, which I just think is nonsensical.
Just one more point on it. What the states say, OK, argy-bargy, the Disability Services Commissioner, she is the one saying to the government, you've got to give us the evidence you're not veering away from the original intent of the scheme. So while this has limited political implications, if the Disability Discrimination Commission...
But of course that's what the Disability Services Commissioner is going to say.
Well, so that's something that the government should engage with and worry about more than a regular argy-bargy with the state. And I think that's a fair call for... It's a statutory position. She's supposed to stick up for those people. That's an important...
Well, sure, but that's obviously would be her position, I think.
And just on the arm wrestle federally over the length of this inquiry, and the broad agreement that it's been very tight and they want to pass this bill in the next sitting fortnight, the coalition is offering the Greens an extension of this NDIS inquiry by 6 months. As Mark Butler said, that would come at the cost of billions. If the Greens agree to extend the inquiry into the capital gains tax negative gearing changes by 6 months as well, which is what the coalition really wants. The Greens, my understanding, is still weighing up options here, so they haven't settled on a position. What does it say about the coalition, though, Jennifer, if they're willing to delay the NDIS changes?
Well, I think it's kind of dangerous for the coalition in this sense because, of course, as you have seen Mark Butler already saying, well, they're not serious about cutting spending or whatever. But they want to prolong the political pain for the government, and the longer that they can kind of keep the attention on all the other changes in the budgets on capital gains, which obviously has got a lot of criticism as well, they think that's better. I'm not sure that that's a kind of great exchange, really, but I don't know if the Greens will agree. But I do think that they will just be seen as, you know, being incredibly, what would you call, just manipulative on this, and opportunistic, and not serious about trying to cut the deficit. So,
well, all parties will have to make a decision pretty soon on this. Parliament not sitting this week, but then back for that sitting fortnight, where they want to get through the NDIS changes, they want to get through the negative gearing and capital gains tax changes as well. Let's turn to the Middle East now. And look, we've heard it a few times before, but this time both the US and Iran are now saying they are close, very close, to reaching a deal to end the war. It comes after a week of renewed hostility, though, and there's still uncertainty about what a peace agreement might look like.
we're very close to having a deal.
In my good conditions with my friend President Trump, we will defend the state of Israel.
His relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu is souring.
Warning, be careful, or you will be on your own very soon.
President Trump has accused Iran of shooting down a US Apache helicopter.
The United States launching retaliatory strikes against Iran.
In response, Iran's Revolutionary Guard targeted US positions in Bahrain.
And we're in the final throes of what will be a very, very good deal that will not allow in any way, shape or form nuclear weapons, etc. And the strait will open up right away.
We've had a number of declarations, as you know. Strait of Hormuz has opened, then a couple of hours later it's closed, then it's open, then it's closed.
Hello, everybody. Just had a big day. We just made a great settlement of the war with Iran, subject to finalization of documents.
Therefore, the war will come to an end on all fronts, including Lebanon.
I just spoke to Bibi.
You have come close to sealing a deal, but at the last minute it has fallen apart.
It'll be soon. Maybe this weekend.
It is possible that it could happen within the next few days. I am hopeful.
The straits are going to open immediately. It's upon signing. Maybe it'll be Saturday or Monday.
So overnight, Donald Trump has posted that an agreement will be signed, he has said, in the coming 24 hours, Iran suggesting it might be a few days. He talked about how great the deal would be, but this bit jumped out. At the appropriate time, when all is calm, we will go in and get the nuclear dust. Cam, that doesn't suggest that nuclear dust, as he calls it, is going to be removed before this war comes to an end.
That's right. I mean, basically, let's assume this does happen. I mean, you know, who knows?
We've been here before.
The amount of nights I've written something that hasn't turned out because of Donald Trump. But basically, what this is interesting. What the deal looks like at this point in time is the minimalist kind of thing that the Americans could accept, which is basically the Strait of Hormuz gets opened, the blockade of uranium ports is lifted, and they'll have 60 days to discuss the nuclear issue, and that's going to be the hard negotiation. But for Donald Trump, there is a basic bottom line here. He has to get a better deal on the nuclear issue than did Barack Obama in 2015 in that nuclear deal, because Trump bagged that deal mercilessly and, in fact, pulled the United States out of it. So that is his only measure of success here. He's already lost so much credibility in the US for the war because his ambitions have shrunk by the week, literally. But if he doesn't get that, he will be
widely panicked.
What do you think?
Will he get a better nuclear deal than Obama?
I think it'd be very, very marginal at best. Firstly, they have to get rid of the Iranians have to agree to get rid of the highly enriched uranium that they have. That's the key thing. And also, what will the moratorium, if any, be on their enrichment program? The Americans are looking at about 15 years. The Iranians don't want that much. So, you know, that's the argy-bargy there. Who's going to get that enriched uranium? How are they going to actually safely remove it as well? There's so much that remains to be negotiated still. So, in a way, while this is sort of going to be touted as a big peace agreement, there really is no agreement beyond opening the Strait of Hormuz, which was opened before the conflict anyway.
Well, yeah, reopening it would be a great thing for the global economy and, you know, Australia would certainly celebrate watching some oil ships go through. But if the whole point of the war, Raf, was to in part deal with Iran's nuclear threat, I mean, you heard it from Mark Butler there. Has this really been worthwhile? He can't say.
Well, firstly, Trump's already failed, right? More enriched uranium under Trump than under Obama, right? Under Obama, some of the stuff gets shipped off to Russia. So further down the enrichment process under Trump than under Obama. On top of that, a lot of the world thought Iran had one thing to threaten America and Israel with, right? The nuclear weapon. Now it turns out Iran's got two weapons. Trump's handed them the proof that Iran can inflict global pain around the world. So farmers in Indonesia aren't eating. Farmers in Australia are paying double the price of fertiliser. Something One Nation never points out when they talk about Donald Trump. Trump and Netanyahu have handed Iran this whole extra way of exerting real pain. On top of that, we were promised regime change, and they've changed the regime, right? They're not theocratic. It's a military regime more willing to kill its own people, more willing to take risks, and more willing to exert global pain. He's just trying to get out of that. Like, that is not a success.
He is trying to get out of this. One of the other sticking points, I assume, Jen, will be Israel and whether it will have any limitations put on it as to how it can pursue Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now, Netanyahu won't want any limitations there. Iran will want limitations as part of this deal. How is that resolved?
Well, exactly. I don't think it is going to be resolved. And I think the Netanyahu government has made it pretty clear that as far as it's concerned, its ability to strike at Hezbollah whenever it feels threatened, which is all the time, will not be restrained at all. So there'll be, you know, no doubt, you know, the odd angry phone call between Trump and Netanyahu. But, I mean, as we've seen, what difference does that make?
How do you think Netanyahu, Raf, would be feeling about the prospects of a deal to end this war?
Well, I don't want to look inside the mind of a world leader, but Israel's about to go into an election campaign. The language used by Netanyahu's opponents, my Hebrew's not great, but he is essentially accused of being cuckolded by Trump, like a far more abrasive word. So you've got a dynamic inside Israeli politics where any sign that Netanyahu has been constrained by Trump is perceived as a real weakness. Trump actually was telling the American media that Netanyahu might not run. So, like, if he's throwing those bombs into the rhetorical bombs into the Israeli political scene, that makes, so even if the strait opens, that makes the ability to get to something like a cessation of violence very, very difficult. And keep in mind, 3,700 people at last count have been killed in Lebanon during Israel's invasion in the 80s. The death toll was about three or four times. Like, that is a hell of a lot of dead people. And about half of the people who've moved in Lebanon won't have a home to go back to. Half of that 1 million people.
And the election is not in October. So I think the prospects of things heating up is actually
Could be a real sticking point, because I think Trump can restrain Netanyahu for a little while, but he can't restrain him, full time. The Israelis definitely see Hezbollah. Mind you, the Iranians, of course, could tell Hezbollah to stop throwing missiles at northern Israel.
Why would they?
So, because if they want to have peace, they could actually do that. I mean, you know, so I mean, there's all sorts of things at play here. But what's really interesting is that Netanyahu's being, as Raf says, he's being so pressured at home to keep that conflict going. Trump is being so pressured at home. I mean, only 2 in 10 Americans believe that this war has been successful. It's less popular in America than was the Vietnam War in the early 70s, according to polls. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable.
What about amongst the Republican hawks, though, who want the job finished? How much pressure is there on Trump from that side?
Well, there is some pressure from Lindsey Graham's of the world, who basically wanted to go and finish off the job. But I think they realise they can't militarily finish off the job because there's nothing more they can really do. They can keep bombing. That didn't do much for the regime. It didn't end the regime. So they're very limited with what they can do militarily, and Trump knows that.
And although it's nobody really, the great majority do not support the war, it's not as though American soldiers are being killed. They don't approve of it, but it's not the kind of white hot issue it actually is in most of the rest of the world.
Although inflation,
the kind of
inflation
thing.
Had a two in front of it in America at the start of the war. Now it's got a four.
Look, I want to get your thoughts to everybody, but Cam in particular, because you've just been in the UK looking at the shipyards. The shock resignation of Jonathan Healey, the Defence Secretary, and the Armed Services Secretary going as well, Al Carnes. They've both quit, claiming that Keir Starmer is just not spending what he needs to be spending on defence to keep the country safe. This puts all sorts of pressure on Keir Starmer. It's being called the breaking point. He won't last much longer after this resignation. But it also came at an awkward time for Australia. Richard Marles was there at the time. He was meant to be holding an event with Healey in a couple of hours. That had to be cancelled. Being stood up, though, might be the least of Australia's problems. What does this mean for AUKUS?
Look, it's a problem. The British side, everyone's been focusing on the US side of AUKUS, you know, Donald Trump, US Virginia-class submarines, etc. The British side, of course, where the Brits and the Australians co-build a submarine late 2030s, is the really main game. And the British industrial submarine industry is absolutely moribund. It needs so much investment, and as does a lot of the British Armed Forces, and that's what Healey has resigned over. He said that Starmer is not investing enough in Britain for their own defences. That includes the submarine arm. So, look, it's not good news for AUKUS. There was a parliamentary report recently in Britain that said that AUKUS, there needs to be greater political leadership from the British government to support AUKUS. Now, if Keir Starmer goes, which he probably will by the end of the year, his replacement will be the fifth Prime Minister to preside over AUKUS. This is not good for AUKUS. It doesn't derail it. I mean, it's a decades-long project, OK? But it absolutely is not healthy. The British side of AUKUS is not healthy at the moment.
and Andy Burnham is expected to be the replacement for Keir Starmer should he win. I think it's Thursday or Friday this week, the Makerfield by-election there. But is it clear at all whether he would increase defence spending? Is that...
Well, I mean, I think you look at Britain, obviously there's a great demand to increase spending, and yet we're looking at a broke country. I mean, Australia's got problems with its budget, big problems with its budget, but compared to England, they're not nearly as severe. So I think, obviously, there will be pressure to not least from the US, to increase spending and actually do something. But I think the other issue in terms of AUKUS for Australia is that, you know, this whole debate that's going on in the Labor Party now will give, you know, fresh momentum to that. I don't think it's going to actually change the outcome, but it demonstrates that Australia is also not putting in the money that it says it will or it should, you know, that they're playing games here on that too.
Burnham's criticised, just from all my English politics podcast consumption, of which I listen to way too many. He is criticised for basically not having a position. He is from the north, like he's from Manchester, but he also ran back to Manchester and left Westminster because he was perceived to be someone who was never willing to nail his colours to the mast. I don't think we've got any indication of what AUKUS would, you know, what would happen to AUKUS under him. But Cam's point's that the most wounding to Australian politics right now, the guy in charge of making sure we build submarines with Britain is saying we're not doing enough to do it. And that's why he left. Like, he's willing to wound Starmer while Starmer is down. He's kicking him while he's down to say, hang on, we're not going to be able to deliver. And that's what lands in Australian politics.
Yeah, no, exactly. Let's get some final observations. Cam.
This week we saw a fascinating power play, David, between the three best-known autocrats in the world, North Korea's Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping in China, Vladimir Putin, Russia. China has always seen North Korea very much as a little brother. 90% of trade from North Korea goes to China. It likes North Korea to stay in its lane. Kim Jong-un's been reaching out to Vladimir Putin lately, giving him troops who'll be actually fighting and dying on the Ukrainian border, weapons in return for a whole bunch of cash to make his impoverished nation a little less impoverished. Xi Jinping looked at this, didn't like it, did a state visit this week with all that fantastic Stalinist hoopla that you get to talk to Kim Jong-un, and Kim Jong-un won lots of benefits from China as a result. So Kim Jong-un is having a moment in the sun. Remember a few years ago he played Donald Trump on a break, right, on those very high-profile summits. Yeah. Well, now he's playing off Russia against
Xi.
China.
Interesting.
And really interesting, and he's doing quite well. So while he's a rat bag, he should not be admired. He's certainly no fool.
He knows how to squeeze a good outcome. Mm. All right, Raf.
Most importantly, let's go Knicks and go Socceroos. They are the two most important things I have to say today. Maybe less importantly, but much more on the insiders page. Jacinta Allen's cabinet and Jacinta Allen's caucus room, they are all watching nervously to see if the significant factional voices can be persuaded. There are a couple of polls coming very soon. Mm. There are federal Labor people who believe, I don't know if it's true, but they believe that Labor's internal polling is already in the teens in Victoria.
Jeez.
They believe it. I don't know if that is true. People inside her government are watching to see if the factional leaders could be persuaded to go and tap her on the shoulder and ask her for a smooth succession. I don't see that movement yet. And despite everything, I have no one's ever said to me, Jacinta Allen is willing to go quietly. And if she's not willing to go quietly, she won't go.
And just to remind people interstate, we're in June. Your election in Victoria is November.
Yep.
And there's this leadership...
5 months to caretaker, and they are running third. State Labor's running third in the polls.
Jennifer.
Well, the good, or at least goodish news, is that nobody expects the Reserve Bank to raise interest rates when it meets on Tuesday. And that's obviously a great relief for millions of households, but also for Jim Chalmers. The bad news is one of the reasons they're not going to expected to raise rates is that the economy is actually weakening really, really quite fast and badly, and that is going to be extremely painful for everyone.
Glass half full, glass half empty. All right, thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, making fun of Donald Trump is not something federal politicians tend to do, but the New South Wales Premier, well, that's a different story. We'll leave you with the dubious talents of Chris Minns. Thanks for watching.
Nothing screams democracy like the UFC. They're eating our cats, they're eating our dogs.
We
can't wait
Trump.
For you to meet Melania.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.